You're listening to Louisiana Insider, a superlative guide to a great state's destinations, hosted by Errol Labor, executive editor of Louisiana Life magazine.
It's our Louisiana song. It's our favorite melody. It's our Louisiana song. Hearing it echo through the cypress tree.
Hey, we have to meet with us really an interesting topic this week. I think they're all interesting, but I think this is interesting in the way that a lot of people really haven't heard much about. With me is Kenan Hoffman, who's the executive director of the local Museum of the Southern Jewish Experience. And he was actually here on the show right around the time that the museum opened. And that was in May of 2021. So this is the second visit. By the way, we have a rule that once a person is on the show 10 times, they get a trophy. So you can just save space.
I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, we haven't designed.
I'll probably reach that at the same time as I get my 10th sub. Okay. at Subway or something.
All right. The name, the Museum for the Southern Jewish Experience. Just looking at that name, and I want to talk a little bit more about the museum itself a little bit later, but that name kind of raises the question, well, does the Jewish experience differ much from other regions in the country? And I guess there are ways that it does, but one way that just kind of pops out, especially from this story, is that the southern part experienced the Civil War and the aftermath of the Civil War and the huge population of the free slaves. And this is part of what the story is about. It centers around two men, Julius Rosenwald, who is a Jewish businessman, and Booker T. Washington, who is an educator, Black educator. And it's just a fascinating story, the way it worked together. So why don't you begin? Tell us about Julius Rosenwald and what happened.
Sure. Well, and what we're talking about, Errol, is a special exhibition at the museum that's there right now. It's going to be there through mid-April of 2024. And it's a photography exhibit by a photographer, a Jewish photographer from Atlanta, Georgia. His name is Andrew Feiler. He's a very well-regarded photographer. He spent years traveling across the South, photo documenting and meeting with people associated with Rosenwald schools. So the title of the exhibition, it's a long title. It's A Better Life for Their Children, Julius Rosenwald, Booker T. Washington, and the 4,978 Schools That Changed America. So that's a pretty provocative title. And
yeah, let's repeat that number again, 4,978 schools.
That's right. That's okay. Right. And that's what Julius Rosenwald and Booker T. Washington, they had a vision to raise the level of education for African Americans in the South. And this was in the early 20th century, during Jim Crow, during the segregation era. And Julius Rosenwald had been president of Sears Roebuck. I don't know how many of your listeners remember Sears Roebuck, but in the olden days, it was the Amazon of the olden days, or the Walmart of the olden days. He was
a Jewish... to buy a lawnmower and your washing machine, you know. So
My mom would give us the Sears catalog at the end of every summer and say, "Circle the clothes you want for school," you know. So, so Julius Rosenwald ran this store or this whole company, a national company, out of his home in Chicago, and he became wealthy, but then he. He turned his attention toward philanthropy, toward helping people, and much informed by his Jewish upbringing, with the values that you help the community out, those less fortunate. And he started working with Booker T. Washington, who was a wonderful educator, one of the first principal educators at Tuskegee Institute in Alabama.
He was and wasn't he the founder or his
he was one of the founders. He was there at right toward the beginning, absolutely. And the what they came up with was that Julius Rosenwald would give a certain amount of funds to a community, but usually around a third, to build a school if the African-American community in that community came up with a third of the funds, and the school board in that community came up with a third of the funds. So it was really, it was a forward thinking kind of philanthropy. Today we would call that a challenge grant. We would also call that a public-private partnership. So these were very progressive ideas. This is like the progressive era, the second decade of the 20th century. And it became very successful. They built modest schoolhouses, but schoolhouses with the purpose of educating mostly rural African-American children who before that time had, you know, were meeting in shacks or in people's homes or not having schools at all. So, you know, between 1917 and 1932, this program funded these 4,900 plus schools all over the South.
He must have had an incredible administrative structure to be able to do all that, to hit contact and raising the money and to do, I mean, 4,978. I mean,
absolutely. And this is
somebody
not,
working hard in the office.
Right. Julius Rosenwald was not on a ladder with a paintbrush and a hammer. Neither was Booker T. Washington. As a matter of fact, Booker T. Washington passed away early on in this program, but is credited for part of this partnership, this Jewish African-American partnership to better conditions for African-Americans in the South. And the legacy of the Rosenwald schools, you see it in some of the graduates, the students who went to Rosenwald schools, people like Congressman John Lewis, poet Maya Angelou, civil rights leaders Vernon Dahmer and Medgar Evers, several of the girls from the Little Rock Nine who integrated the high school there after they had been educated at Rosenwald schools. So, you know, as we look at the history of the South, the history of education, Black history, these Rosenwald schools really served a very important function.
Okay. If you, by the way, if you search, I guess, if you Google Rosenwald schools, you can see a list of the schools and in the state that were there. And from what I was able to tell, that there were four in Louisiana of the schools. Now, I know that the city's recreation department has something
called— Oh, that's how many are exist today, because, you know, these things mostly crumbled away, you know, after integration. But before that, I believe that Brian Davis of the Historic Trust in Louisiana identified several hundred Rosenwald schools that were built across Louisiana.
Okay. Now, a typical school, just from the pictures I've seen, well, they're like usually like maybe two classrooms, and it kind of, you know, the image of the old country school, you know, the one room school. This was another step. This was two classrooms. They were nice, but they were modest buildings. But didn't they also include housing for the teachers?
Well, they, I mean, you are correct that as part of this progressive program, the architecture was even progressive. There would be plans that would be given to a community of how to build a school that was efficient, large windows for natural light, a movable wall to be able to section off parts of the classroom to have differentiated education, let's say. Every school had to be on at least an acre of land, so that there was room outside for recreation as well as for gardening. So these kind of progressive ideas in design you know, were incorporated, were baked into the Rosenwald School's program. And teachers came from the mostly from the community that they were there, so they had places to live already. I'm not sure if they any lived in the schools themselves. But here's something that Andrew Filer, the photographer, told us when he gave a lecture here at the museum. He said that the schools were nice, they were well built, but they couldn't be too nice. Because if they were too nice, if they were too fancy, then the white population might very well resent that, get jealous. That's when you would have vandalism. That's when you might have arson, burning the place down. So it's sort of a sad commentary that when you're trying to do something positive in for racial equity, you also have to consider the negative impact that positive action can have on folks who are segregationists or racists.
But the school boards had to buy into this everywhere they went, I would think. Okay.
The school boards did have to buy into this, and that was sometimes a tricky thing. And there were some communities that did not want to have Rosenwald funds come to their community.
Okay. And so even though they got almost 5,000, there were some places where there was resistance that they just couldn't do it.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
But to get them, I mean, the school boards would have been all white at the time.
Absolutely.
Okay. And so there must have been, I mean, some support out there to be able to get that many schools.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, in each community, there was a different levels of support. You know, the vision was a third, a third, a third for the funding. And sometimes the African-American third would come in kind, meaning donated lumber, donated labor, sometimes the actual building, the painting of the school, those sorts of things would be donated sometimes by the African-American community in lieu of the cash third of the cost.
Now, was the land donated or was the land included in the cost of the project?
Sometimes one way, sometimes another. One of the exhibit contains these beautiful black and white photos, and each photo comes with a story, like a story panel underneath it. And one of the best, I mean, they're all great, but there's a photo of two people holding up, two African-American people holding up an old photograph of their ancestor, their parents, who were born into slavery. After the Civil War, they started farming, they made some money, they bought land, and then they donated a piece of, when the Rosenwald program started, they donated a piece of their land for a school. And their children went on to help run the school. And then their children were in the school, you know. So, I mean, it was a generational kind of a thing. So, yeah, the land could be donated by the district or by individuals.
The and these were all elementary or grade school? Like,
yes, these were all secondary. I mean, yes, elementary grammar schools. Whatever they would call them then.
Right. So Rosenwald is a hero of the saga. But tell me a little about Booker T. Washington. We know he was an educator. We know he started or was key to starting Tuskegee. Mm-hmm. But he was quite an accomplished person in America.
Absolutely. Absolutely. When you look at, Black work. We're coming to the end of Black History Month. I know this is going to be this is going to happen next week, but Booker T. Washington was at the turn of the century, right there at the beginning of the nascent civil rights movement. If not the movement, then at least taking part in the discussion about how African Americans can reach either equality or parity with their white Americans. Some people disagreed with his thoughts that African Americans should become somewhat self-sufficient. They should educate themselves in vocational trades so that they can be economically self-sufficient, as opposed to someone like W.E.B. Du Bois, who was more on the side of we need to fight for equality. Straight up, we just need, you know, we should be considered and given equal rights, not have to somewhat fend for ourselves, let's say. And both, I'm not a scholar of African-American history, so it's much more complicated than that. But, you know, there were different strands, different philosophies about how African-Americans should approach their own well-being as citizens of the United States. And Booker T. Washington was a major part of that discussion in the early 20th century.
I remember reading that at Tuskegee, which Washington headed, he hired a guy, I guess it was the agriculture department, to look at the sort of things that grew in the South and figure out ways to make it more productive. And that was George Washington Carver. And that's the whole beginning. I don't know how much validity there is about the thing about the peanut, but he's always associated with the peanut. But that was a southern crop, and how could you make it more viable? In fact, he did find a lot of new ways to do things with the peanut, which would make them economically resourceful.
He's George Washington Carver is one of my heroes because peanut butter is one of my favorite foods. Growing up, I survived on peanut butter sandwiches because I'm a picky eater.
Do you prefer crunchy or plain?
You know, I grew up with crunchy because that's what we had in the house. And then when I got to college and realized I can buy anything I want, I switched to plain. But every once in a while, you know, I like to go back to the crunchy.
Anyway, back to Carver.
Well, and Carver, and again, this isn't an exhibit about Carver, so I don't really know. I can't really speak too much to that. But this exhibit,
Booker T. Washington, that gave him his chance at Tuskegee.
Well, that's wonderful. Yeah. That is fantastic. But I was going to say that that folks that are in town, certainly students and teachers, we have a wonderful field trip for students to come specifically to the museum to see this Rosenwald School exhibit. They go through the exhibit, but there's also a sort of a classroom portion where we talk about, you know, some of the ideas of working together with different kinds of communities, because Rosenwald, being a Jewish businessman from Chicago, Booker T. Washington, being an African-American educator from the South, you know, it's wonderful what occurred when these two different types of people start working together, and they each brought their own, you know, Rosenwald, he brought a lot of money, but he also brought a lot of vision. Booker T. Washington also with the vision, but also with the connections across the South to other African-American communities, you know, to work with them to make these schools a reality.
Well, the part about the deal, okay, I can understand the school board putting up one third and Rosenwald putting up one third, but the part about where the Black community had to put up one third, I mean, they would not have been organized. I mean, there wouldn't have been any kind of central apparatus that, you know, let me write you a check for one third. I mean, how was that done? Or was it, as you said, in kind?
So, and again, we're talking about nearly 5,000 schools. So there isn't one way that any of this happened. This was I'm giving a very simplistic overview saying one third, one third, one third. That was the template. But each school has its own story of how it was formed. The churches, the Black churches in communities had always had a lot to do with organizing the community.
The ministers, you can see them taking the lead.
Absolutely. The mothers, you know, the women in the African American community, always very interested in taking care of their family, taking care of the children, finding ways to make their lives better. So I think, you know, each community has its own story. Some of those stories are expressed in this exhibit. Down in Donaldsonville, Louisiana, where the River Road African American Museum is, they have a renovated Rosenwald School that they've recently opened. I think it was last October. And we're going to be chartering a bus from New Orleans in April to drive down there and see it and hear from the people that helped to renovate this school. Because it's a fascinating story. I mean, you know, to preserve a historic building and then be able to tell the stories of what happened there. That's what museums are all about.
And this would have been a typical two-room type of Rosenwald.
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet. I'm really looking forward myself to getting on this bus and going down there and seeing, you know, some of our museum staff have been down there to see what it's all about and make sure that, that you know, they're going to be able to accommodate a big group of people coming through. And they said they're thrilled to pieces to have us come out.
Now, there have been statistics about the number of people that benefited from this, like how many kids got educated and do you...
Yeah, I don't have that off the top of my head, but, you know, we're having a speaker soon, an author named Stephanie Deutsch. She wrote a book, You Need a Schoolhouse. I think that's what it's called. And she's going to be speaking on, you know, she's done plenty of research on the Rosenwald schools because she wrote a whole book about it. So I'm sure she's going to have that kind of statistical information.
Yep. How did tell me about Rosenwald beyond that? I mean, did he go on? Mm-hmm. He really lived a fulfilled life after creating 5,000 schools. I mean, that's pretty
sure.
Good.
And that's not all he did. He supported Jewish causes and institutions around the country. He supported schools and universities and museums. He was asked to help fund a YMCA in Chicago. This was, I think, in like 1910. And he said he would do it, but only if they also built a YMCA for African-Americans, which they did. And that sort of spurred the building of YMCAs for African-Americans. Of course, this was a time when facilities were segregated. So you would have a black Y and a white Y.
Was there any sort of linkage between the Jewish community and the black community in terms of at least interest in their cause? I mean, did they both feel like maybe they were kind of like outsiders in another society? Was that?
Well, this is, you know, boy, do I have some graduate courses for you to take. There's been lots of scholarship, you know, tracing the relationship between African Americans and Jews over time. And there have been times when there was great working relationship during the civil rights movement. I mean, the NAACP, the first president was a Jewish man of the NAACP in the early 20th century. During the civil rights movement in the 60s, when the Freedom Riders came down on buses to register blacks to vote in Mississippi, those buses were filled with Jewish college students from, you know, from the Northeast. So there has been an affinity, the idea of being oppressed, the idea of helping out the less fortunate. Definitely those things have occurred. And then in more recent times, there have been fractures between the Jewish community and the African American community. And I don't want to speak, you know, for any group, because Jews are not monolithic. They're monotheistic, but not monolithic. And African Americans are not monolithic. So there's always, you know, tension as well as cooperation. Dillard had a wonderful Black Jewish relations kind of initiative many years ago, and then it sort of died away, and it's recently been reborn. And the Jewish Federation in New Orleans has efforts to work with the African American community and other communities throughout New Orleans, because as you know, New Orleans is full of unique communities, and what makes New Orleans wonderful is that those communities don't keep themselves separate. They mix, they merge, they share, and that's what makes New Orleans the best place in the world.
The when you mentioned about the Freedom Riders, I was trying to think about the awful incident in Mississippi where those five who were captured essentially by Klan members, and they were, it was a nationwide manhunt for them, and they were all killed. And I remember one of them, his name was like Goldman or something, and it was
Yeah, you're talking about Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman.
Yeah.
And so Schwerner and Goodman were young Jewish men from the Northeast. And Cheney was an African American man from Mississippi. Yes, and if you've seen the movie Mississippi Burning, that is the fictionalized account of their murder by the Klan and the FBI's investigation into that and finding their bodies in shallow graves. There was plenty. In 1968, the synagogue and the rabbi's home in Jackson, Mississippi were dynamited by the KKK. That same year, the synagogue in Meridian, Mississippi was dynamited by the KKK. And this was because members of those congregations were supporting the civil rights movement. Now, there were plenty of members of those congregations who were afraid to support the civil rights movement because of that exact reason, that if we stick our necks out, we're already maybe there may be some anti-Semitism in the community. If we go against the majority opinion, then we're making ourselves a target. So plenty of folks stayed silent on the sidelines, but you also had some people who were active in the civil rights movement in the South, Jewish people, oftentimes not so much on the picket lines and during the marches, but behind the scenes, doing the work quietly behind the scenes to help spur the civil rights movement.
I remember having met the writer, he's still alive, Calvin Trillin, who had early in his career did a lot of articles about the civil rights movement. He was in New York, but he came to New Orleans fairly frequently, covering it. And some of his sources, the people he got to know, were Jewish families who were also involved in the issue. And so he was very active behind the scenes in that. There's a lot of articles on that.
Well, and of course he's Jewish. He's from Kansas City, but he went to Yale. He was roommates with Peter Wolfe, who was a writer from New Orleans, who just wrote a great book about Leon Gotcha, the Sugar King.
Oh wait, let me say that. I read that book. It's a great book.
It is a great book. Yeah, and if people didn't see our program with Peter, it's on our YouTube channel. We had a great conversation about his book and we filmed it, and it's on our YouTube channel. But Bud Trillin was down here last year, and Peter Wolfe brought him to the museum, and he got to go through the museum, and it was very special. And you're right, he wrote a lot during that time period, and his Jewish sensibilities, you can see them in his essays about that time period.
He's also a big fan of Moscow's restaurant. I'd like to go there.
He's a big fan of a lot of restaurants. He's a foodie.
He even said that he liked Moscow so much they did an article in the New Yorker one time nominating or suggesting Mama Moscow's for the, not the Pulitzer Prize, the other one, the big one, the one they give in Sweden,
the Nobel Prize.
I didn't think of it. Yeah, nominate Mama Moscow's for the Nobel Prize, and she didn't win. Okay, he said Henry Kissinger won instead that year, but I guess Mama.
They made a big mistake that year.
Well, with your museum emphasizing the Southern experience, what can be said about Louisiana and the Jewish experience?
Sure. Well, the museum covers 13 Southern states, but we are here in Louisiana. And so when you come through the museum, all states are represented, but you see most about Louisiana and New Orleans because here we are. So New Orleans has the oldest Jewish congregation outside of the original 13 colonies. It's what is today Touro Synagogue. It was started in 1828. So we have a very old Jewish history here in New Orleans and in Louisiana. It's interesting, the first Europeans here were the French, and they promulgated the Code Noir, the Black Codes. It was their laws for how do you deal with slaves in the New World. But the first paragraph of the Code Noir says no Jews in French colonies. France was a Catholic country. That was the state religion, so they no Jews. Now, of course, when you're trying to start a colony in a mosquito-ridden, crocodile-infested swamp, you sort of will take anybody who comes along.
Absolutely.
So there are, it's documented that there were Jews in the early days of the colony, but it really took until the turn of the 19th century, the beginning of the 19th century, that we start to see a real community form. And over the years, Julius Rosenwald's daughter, Edith Rosenwald, married Edgar Stern, who was a prominent New Orleans businessman. They went on to become very important in the city for civic actions and philanthropy. And anyone who's been to Longview House and Gardens, that was their home. And you can learn a lot about their civic activism there, especially during the civil rights movement. So the history goes back to colonial times. It comes all the way up to the present. And it continues to evolve and change. That's why we're called the Museum of the Southern Jewish Experience and not the Museum of Southern Jewish History, because it's a continuation. It's going on all the time.
The Stearns also started a television station, WDSU,
They were
in
involved
New
in that.
Orleans.
They helped get Dillard formed.
And that was the first TV station. And I know that one thing they wanted to do, besides give entertainment, was especially a little bit later when I started doing editorials on WDSU, that they wanted there to be another voice out there, and especially talking about those kind of issues. And Channel 4 followed suit too. And so TV really developed sort of like the alternative editorial voice on special racial issues. At the time, the newspaper wasn't doing it. Now they do, but it was important, so.
Sure. One of the best schools in the city, Newman, that's named after Isidore Newman, who gave the money to start it in, I believe, 1903. Originally, it was formed to be the school for the Jewish orphans at the Jewish Orphans Home, which was just up the street on Jefferson and St. Charles. But very quickly, it became known as an academically superior school, and everybody wanted to go there. And so, when you look around, you can see elements of Jewish, I'll just say, participation and contribution to our city today. We just had Mardi Gras 2 weeks ago. I know it seems a lot longer ago already, but when people hear the Mardi Gras anthem, Mardi Gras Mambo, which is you hear it all the time around Mardi Gras, that was written by a Jewish man from New Orleans, a man named Lew Welsh. And so when they hear that song, whether they realize it or not, they are having a Southern Jewish experience. And that's why the museum's here. We're here to share these kind of stories, to say that everybody has something to contribute to their community. And if everybody is accepted, then our communities will be stronger. That's the universal message.
Okay. Is the museum doing well?
The museum is doing well. We've been open. We're coming up on 3 years being open. The first year was like very pandemic-y. But we've had over 25,000 people come through from across the state, across the country, and we get a lot of international visitors as well.
And it's located downtown, not far from the D-Day or the World War II Museum. So if you're visiting one, you can visit the other.
Very much so. We are slightly smaller than they are. and so we welcome folks from near and far.
And if anybody wants more information on activities and the things we're talking about, you recommend the website, which is msje.org.
MSJE.org, and you can find out about programs, you can find out about special exhibits, hours, you know, all that kind of stuff. We want to see everybody come to the museum.
Okay. I recommend that book about Gottschall. It's a seriously good book, and more than I thought it would be, because the first part of it is well, he's from France, okay, this young Jewish boy who comes from France. He has to make his way in Louisiana, becomes a peddler going along the river road, and then eventually develops the store, and then it becomes a pioneer in the sugar industry. Just a fascinating story of this guy who came here with nothing.
And it is. And it's got some personal elements in it, too, because Peter Wolfe, the author, traces his ancestry back to Leon Gottschall. So, you know, he's writing about his own family. And so that makes the story even more compelling. And it's an easy read, and it's a fun read, and very informative. And we sell it in our museum store, by the way.
Okay, well, that's good to know. Okay, well, I recommend to everybody. This has been Kenneth Hoffman, the executive director of the MSJE. Kenneth, thank you again. You now have
Wonderful.
Two appearances, eight away from getting that trophy, okay?
Anytime. You just give me a call. Let me know.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to Louisiana Insider. Subscribe, like, and rate our show where you listen to your podcasts, and follow us on social media at Louisiana Life Mag. Executive producer for Louisiana Insider is Kelly Massico, in cooperation with Louisiana Life Magazine. For subscription information to Louisiana Life, call 504-828-1380. Our theme music was provided by Rich Collins. Hey, that's me. Join us again next week for more discoveries inside Louisiana.